Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in California's decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, how will school districts make up for lost learning during the pandemic? And later, a local historian weighs in on the recognition of Juneteenth as a federal holiday. But first, a new state law required school districts to keep detailed attendance and engagement records this year to make sure students online didn't fall behind. But an FM89 investigation found students were counted present when they did little more than log in. Sarith Hawk took a deep dive into the data at one school district. She found that attendance numbers do not reflect the frustrating reality of the school year.
After over a year online, Madera South High School adopted a hybrid schedule in April so students could return to classrooms a couple of days a week. But walk into Rodia Montgomery Gentry's 12th grade economics class in early June, and it felt like school was already out. Desks with plastic dividers lined the room, but there were only three students.
Everyone, would you mind turning on your camera? It's our last day, might as well.
Most of the students Montgomery Gentry was talking to were still online. Out of 27 logged in, 8 had their cameras turned on, but most of those cameras pointed at the ceiling.
And the students have heard probably every single class time me announce, so-and-so, are you here? Put in the chat if you're here, unmic yourself if you're here, nothing.
It was a challenging year for Montgomery Gentry and other teachers. Just because students were officially in attendance, or at least logged in, that doesn't mean they were participating or even there. Senior Daniel Lupian-Seha was one of the few students in the room. He says he had always cared deeply about school, but in the pandemic, he lost his motivation, his drive. Online learning made classwork seem, well, empty.
It felt like if it wasn't in person, then it just didn't feel as real. It felt like a phone call versus actually like being there and talking with someone.
Madera Unified is a poor district. Nearly 90% of students receive a free or reduced price lunch. Here at Madera South High, the vast majority of students are English learners. 70% speak Spanish at home, and others speak indigenous languages like Zapoteco and Mixteco. So how are these students doing? FM89 filed a Public Records Act request for the school's attendance records, and officially, the chronic absenteeism rate was just 5%, meaning nearly all of its students were going to class. But that's not what teachers and students were seeing. And even the district admits that official statistic is misleading.
It's inflated. I mean, it's absolutely inflated.
Allison Crafton, director of student services at Madera Unified, was in charge of making sure records were compliant with state requirements.
And you can literally be on your phone with your friends and YouTube and or sleeping.
But that's not how the district was supposed to count attendance. Under a law signed by Governor Newsom last June, administrators were required to track not only whether students showed up, but how much they participated in distance learning. For example, whether they communicated with their teacher or turned in assignments. But even though we requested it, the district didn't share that detail with us. And neither did other districts in the Valley, like Fresno and Clovis Unified. And so, Crafton says, the true level of student engagement remains unknown.
And quite frankly, I don't know that there's any way to tell.
Senior Daniel Lupian-Seha was counted as present when he was online. He would log on, but he wouldn't do the work. Eventually, taking a job pulling weeds from grape crops seemed like a more sane use of his time.
I was mostly in the fields, like working, trying to earn money, because that seemed more important to me at the time than just keeping up my grades.
But when school reopened, he changed course.
What helped me get back into school was realizing that if I don't put in the effort into my work, I might not graduate.
One way you can judge how engaged students were this year is with their grades.
Because you were here last semester.
In Montgomery Gentry's economics class, 11 students got D's and F's. That's twice as much as during a normal year, where she says the average is 4 to 5. Econ, or civics, is a graduation requirement, so students who fail this class can't graduate. Many students could get by with marked attendance by either logging in, turning in work, or having contact with teachers. But without the requirement to turn cameras on, and with piling workloads, Crafton says, the number of D's and F's shot up in the first semester.
That if they weren't self-motivated to learn, and even if they were, some of the depression, some of the sadness, some of the feeling overwhelmed, feeling very apathetic about school, kicked in to a degree that really interfered with them.
Districts were required to reach out to students if they dropped off. Crafton says part of the district's plan was more home visits. This past year, the district logged more than 4,000 home visits. In a normal year, that number was 500. Visits ranged from engagement attempts to meal deliveries and award recognitions. Despite the challenges, Crafton says she believes the law forced the district to make necessary changes to address individual student needs.
What we sometimes lost sight of is the human compassion and understanding of why perhaps that family or that child that day or that month or whatever is not in a place to be able to receive any of the things that we want to teach him or her.
The law allowing distance learning expires at the end of the month, and students will return to classes 5 days a week in the fall.
You have your final on Thursday.
Back in Ms. Rodia Montgomery Gentry's nearly empty classroom, she's getting ready to sign off for the last day of school, addressing both students in the class and online.
It's been an honor to be called your teacher. And it's been an honor to be called your guys' teacher.
Tears begin to form in her eyes as she addresses a screen of digital squares.
This is hard on you. It's hard on teachers. But you made it. You made it.
Montgomery Gentry says she believes the most important lesson for students this year was resiliency, a life lesson they'll carry into adulthood. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Sarith Hawk.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Continuing our conversation about how the pandemic impacted education, I spoke with a group of researchers and local administrators about how to make up for the lost learning that occurred for many students in the past academic year. I talked with Allison Crafton, Director of Student Services for Madera Unified, Natalie Wheatfall-Lum, Director of P16 Education Policy at the Education Trust West, and Heather Huff, Executive Director of Policy Analysis for California Education, more commonly known as PACE. Also joining the conversation from Fresno Unified were Jeremy Ward, the Assistant Superintendent of College and Career Readiness, and Heather Allen, Executive Officer for the district's Instructional Division. So Heather Huff, you work with PACE, which has been researching what is typically thought of as learning loss, although I understand maybe a better term is learning lag that has resulted from the pandemic. Can you briefly summarize some of the more significant findings?
Since the pandemic started and schooling was disrupted initially because of the school closures in March 2020, and then as we navigated various factors, researchers have been concerned about the impact on student learning. And so we, as a network of researchers affiliated with PACE, have been studying a variety of impacts on student learning and social-emotional well-being as well. Most recently, we released a report that documented what we are calling learning lag as a result of lost learning opportunities or schooling disruptions as of winter of this 2021. And what we found is that California students in the 19 school districts in which we had formative assessment data are approximately 2.5 months behind in both English, language arts, and mathematics. but that the effect is much stronger for particular students, namely students that are low income and students that are learning English. For example, students that are low income are about just over three months behind in English language arts where they would be in a typical year, compared to only 1 month behind for non-socioeconomically disadvantaged students. And for students learning English, they're about 3.5 months behind compared to only 2 months behind for students not learning English in English language arts. So one of the things that we are very concerned about as we monitor this learning is the differential impact on students and how students in groups that were already disadvantaged, they are being differentially disadvantaged by the consequences and situations of the pandemic.
The students at Fresno Unified fall into that category of students who have been traditionally disadvantaged. And I'm wondering if either Heather or Jeremy could weigh in on what you have witnessed as a district and what your strategies are going to be in the fall to try to make up for some of that learning lag.
Sure. I mean, I think that we do see similar patterns. The majority of our students in our district fall into those categories. So what we see is that it's been most challenging. It was most challenging early on in the pandemic to make sure that kids had access to internet and wireless to really be able to connect and to continue learning last year. And as we moved throughout this year, it's remained difficult. We see outcomes in things like graduation and grading. So things that we're doing next year that we already know we're going after strongly to help support our students is in semester one of next year, all kids in Fresno Unified will have a 30-minute longer school day. And then as we move into semester two, we'll be using that extra 30-minute really for more targeted student intervention groups beyond kind of all students. So really feeling like those extra time is really an effort to add back some of the lost time that happened this year with some of the reduction in instructional minutes and particularly face-to-face instructional minutes that kids got. So that's a major intervention or a major strategy that we're going after. Also going after vastly expanded credit recovery options for our high school students, expanded after-school programs, expanded summer school programs in effect right now this summer. So we're really trying to approach it from multiple sides. We've also invested in additional training for teachers about really how to receive our kids and support students who are re-entering in a different way than when they left us potentially. So those are some of the strategies that we're going to be using and implementing next year as we're really back full time for all of our kids.
Natalie Wheatfall-Lum, you have been leading the work that EdTrust West has been doing on K-12 school reopenings. What are the kind of steps that you're recommending districts take to help students who may have fallen behind?
Thank you for the question, Kathleen. One of our major focuses is basically just framing this opportunity as a way for schools and districts in the education system generally to see this return to school as not only a time where we need to address the needs of students who have been most impacted by the pandemic, which are the student groups that Heather mentioned, low-income students, English learners, students of color, but also an opportunity to think differently about school and to reimagine school in a holistic way, to transform systems to better serve those students generally. We know that students have experienced significant impacts from the pandemic, but there have been long-standing inequities in the education system. And because of the disruption in the system, we have an opportunity to think differently about how we provide education to students right now. And there are several ways that this can happen, and they're outlined in a report that we actually partnered with Heather at PACE with, as well as our partners at Californians for Justice, which is a student advocacy organization that does do deep work in Fresno Unified. And we've outlined a number of practices that have been proven in research to support the students most marginalized in our education system. And it focuses on creating trusting relationships with students and families, developing culturally responsive and rigorous curricula, looking at students' holistic needs and assessing students at an individual level to help meet those needs, and also making sure that all stakeholders across the school and district community are engaged in the decision-making around how to meet student needs right now. The best way to assess student needs is to directly hear what those needs are from students and families. So those are some of the areas that we are encouraging leaders to focus on right now to center the students that have been most marginalized during the pandemic and also well before the pandemic and how we return to school.
So we know that obviously steps are being taken at a school level, at a district level, but also at a state level and a policy level to help students succeed in the upcoming academic year. And Allison Crafton, you're with Madera Unified, and I understand that there's a particular piece of legislation that you've been tracking pretty closely, AB 104. Can you tell us a little bit about it and why it could be so significant for students?
Sure. So yes, we have been tracking it pretty diligently because it first came on our radar around early February, and when it was presented, it was presented similarly to the other assembly bills that reduce credit requirements for graduation for certain identified groups such as migrant or newcomers, foster, fit, juvenile delinquents, and military. And so we were familiar with those bills and the requirements of those bills and the processes that were involved in those bills and how you were able to identify a student that may qualify, then the steps from that point on with meeting with the families to discuss the ramifications if they chose to go that route, and then to the back end stuff, the stuff where you have to set up all of the systems, the student information systems, to capture it appropriately. So we knew that this could potentially have a major impact on our juniors and seniors. It's a three-part bill. It doesn't just address state graduation requirements. It addresses retention. It also addresses pass, no pass for a grade change. And then it addresses credit requirements for graduation dropping to state requirements. So we were focused predominantly on the latter because it had the most potential for the largest impact. And because I come from an alternative education background, I knew it would really potentially benefit our alternative education students, as well as possibly give some of our students who are still in the comprehensive setting some hope again and not to feel as though there was no alternative other than to become a dropout or a student who was a non-completer. So we've been tracking it, and I'm very proud of our district because a few weeks before the end of the school year, unfortunately, it has not passed yet. I believe it is at this point still with the Senate, and we are waiting in the next couple of weeks. We should hear if it does indeed pass. But because we had some students who would have met the state requirements and likely would have chosen to go that route, we did state that if they were able to do that by the end of June, and in fact, we were able to verify that, on paper, we would allow those students to actually participate in the graduation ceremony in anticipation the bill would pass. That's never been done before, and so I was really proud of our district for being student-centered and gracious to our families through this really difficult time and allowing them to celebrate in hopes that this is going to pass. We do have some students who fit into what we call the summer school bucket. So even with the change in graduation requirements, it would require them to go through summer school. And there will be a ceremony at the conclusion of summer session that they will have an opportunity to participate in. We maintained that. That is a practice in our district we maintained, but we did allow those students that we felt that could make it by June to have that experience in anticipation of its passage.
Jeremy Ward, given your role with Fresno Unified, overseeing college and career readiness and career technical education, what are your thoughts on this legislation and how significant it might be for students?
So we did see an increased number of non-grads by the month of May than we typically would. And we're anticipating, hopeful, that that's going to play out very positively for our students. We did put into place, in addition to hoping that the legislation would work out positively for us and for our community, we put into place a more expanded summer program and summer credit recovery options for students with a goal that we would get all of our non-grads in the month of May to be able to get to the point of graduation by the end of the summer. So typically we anticipate that there's going to be summer sessions of credit recovery through about mid-July. We are actually going all the way through the Friday before school starts the following week in August. So there's four full sessions of summer credit recovery for our kids. And I don't know if that's what we want to jump on and talk about now. And Heather could probably, you know, add a little bit more to that as well. But we I think, hope in conjunction with that bill, along with our expanded efforts to get more kids through and give them more opportunities, that we're going to be able to get every kid there is our goal.
Yeah, our expanded programs, you know, we expanded our summer credit recovery programs, not just for current seniors and juniors, but for students in all grade levels. And again, for our juniors and seniors, although we put a priority focus on students who, right, if you needed a state-required graduation class, that would be your priority for recovery. But we are really continuing to push hard into opportunities for kids to complete because we just have had a lack of clarity about the timeline of that bill. And we know there are kids who are really eager to get done and who are close and who can get done in these next couple weeks. So we're just continuing to push hard on that front to support them.
Sure. So we just have a couple of minutes before we have to wrap up. But Heather Huff, as you reflect back on this really extraordinary period of time that we have lived through, from a research perspective, what lessons do you think we could take away from this pandemic?
We spent a lot of time when we were putting together the brief that became Reimagine and Rebuild that Natalie mentioned. We worked with over 40 organizations in California to take stock of where we were and to chart a different path forward. And I think that what all of these organizations identified is that we have such an incredible opportunity ahead, not just because of the need to reimagine to meet students' needs and the money, which is also incredible, but also the disruption that we have encountered in education and the incredible innovation that we've seen. It's been a really hard year for parents, for students, and for educators. But we've seen teachers and administrators rise to challenge after challenge after challenge and innovate while they're exhausted and taking care of their own families and living through a pandemic. And I think part of what we've seen is that our system does have the potential to innovate. And we can build from that in thinking about what needs to change and how we can rework our systems that already were not really meeting the needs of many students in California. How we can build from that innovation to create a different system that better serves our students.
We've been talking with Heather Huff from PACE, Heather Allen and Jeremy Ward from Fresno Unified, Allison Crafton with Madera Unified, and Natalie Wheatfall-Lum from EdTrust West. Thank you all so much for being on the panel today.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Over a four-year period, police officers in Bakersfield broke 45 bones in 31 people. And in no case did the officers involved in those encounters violate departmental policy. That's the finding of an investigation from the California Reporting Project, a public radio-led collaboration looking into police misconduct. What keeps a community safe has been a big discussion this week in Bakersfield, as the city council has voted to boost annual spending on the police department to $133 million, making it 42% of the city's overall budget. Joining me now to talk about all of this, Molly Peterson, who's the manager of the California Reporting Project and who edited this story. Molly, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
So what does it mean that police officers broke 45 bones in 31 people?
Well, it depends on who you ask. When we talk to the police department itself, they say that that number may even potentially be low and that sometimes breaking bones is necessary. When we talk to people in the community and people who actually had been on the receiving end of some of those baton strikes and you know, dog bites, people described long-term injuries. And then there's the question of what this means for the community in the long term. What are the long-term impacts to breaking people's bones. A survey done by a community collaborative that's looking into potential reforms in Bakersfield pointed out that 1 in 5 people are afraid to call 911. So I think there's some real questions of community trust as well.
And whose bones got broken? I mean, what kind of people are we talking about?
Well, some of them were bad guys accused of really doing bad things. One of the people we spoke with is in prison on a 20-year sentence. He had a bone broken in a confrontation at the Vagabond Inn in Bakersfield after he threatened an ex-girlfriend. But others of them were not necessarily suspected of doing anything more significant than a vehicle code infraction when they were confronted. So one man whose case we read about but did not speak to, was biking the day after Thanksgiving in 2017 without a bike light. Officers noticed this and chased him. He left his bike and he ran to a nearby yard where one officer pulled him down off a fence and hit his arm with a baton hard enough to cause an open fracture where the bone's sticking out of the skin. Eventually, he was charged not with the bike light violation, but with resisting arrest and battering a police officer. Those charges were dismissed.
Were any of the officers reprimanded or held accountable in any way?
No, they weren't. And Sergeant Robert Pear, who's a spokesman for the Bakersfield Police Department, says that's a sign that the department is training officers to use force correctly.
The fact that no one has been disciplined for it during that, whatever the date range for that, is not unusual. And I think it's representative that after review, that officers were doing it within the scope of their law and in a manner prescribed by the law.
Sergeant Pear points out that while the department looks into every use of force, that these results aren't surprising to him, essentially. That we pointed out 31 cases where sergeants looked at this use of force and found it reasonable or within policy every time.
So is he right? I mean, what policies does the Bakersfield Police Department have when it comes to using force and investigating the use of force?
Like a lot of police departments in California, the Bakersfield Police Department's manual is based on a private product called Lexapol, which exists to help police departments stay up to date with the latest developments in California law and in the definition of things like serious injury and deadly force. The police department's manual says that you have to use force that's reasonable and that you have to intervene if not you see another officer using force that's not reasonable. But reasonable is given a lot of leeway and there's a lot of factors to decide what's going on. After the fact, after a use of force, an officer reports the incident to a supervisor, usually a sergeant, who comes out and investigates, possibly even talks to the person who was involved in the encounter. And that sergeant writes a report that's stored in a system called Blue Team. That report is supposed to be reviewed by a lieutenant and sometimes even a captain. There's also a use of force working group in the Bakersfield Police Department that looks at data and tries to look at trends within how force is used. And there are individual audits by the Quality Assurance Unit. Basically, they look at an individual event and see whether it was handled properly.
How does Bakersfield compare to other police departments in these practices?
Well, I talked to Seth Stoughton, who is a law professor who testified for the prosecution at Derek Chauvin's trial in the killing of George Floyd. He also used to be a cop in Florida. And I had him look at one of these Blue Team reports written by a sergeant, and he said that the report was woefully inadequate. He said there wasn't enough detail, not enough detail for someone to explain what was okay or acceptable about that use of force. And there was no description of what to improve for next time.
An officer's use of force, even a relatively low-level use of force, is really a significant government intrusion onto individual liberty and autonomy. It's a significant incident.
Basically, Stoughton says that reports after the fact that look into whether or not force was justified, even if it's a relatively small injury, and in fact, in this case, we're talking about incidents where there was a result of a serious injury. Stoughton says that it's important for there to be detail about how and why it was okay to use this much force and what could be done next time to minimize the impact of incidents exactly like this.
Well, and there's some context here. I mean, since 2017, there's been an open investigation by the California Department of Justice into the Bakersfield Police Department. What's the status of the police department now?
Right. The then Attorney General Kamala Harris opened these investigations, one into the Kern County Sheriff's Office and the other into the Bakersfield Police Department. That Kern County Sheriff's Office investigation was settled in December. And as a result of that, sometime soon, the Kern County Sheriff's will start wearing body cameras. There's going to be some different documentation about how they interact with the community. That investigation, the state level Department of Justice investigation, remains open. And when I asked the Department of Justice about it, they said that they, out of respect for the integrity of the investigation, didn't want to comment on it until it was settled.
So this week, the city council voted to boost funding for policing in Bakersfield. You attended that meeting virtually. What happened?
The meeting was really, really raucous. The city council had decided to give 15 minutes of public debate for the pro side, for the budget proposal as constituted, 15 minutes for people who disagreed with it, despite the fact that there had been a letter sent to the city council the week before from the ACLU of Southern California saying, hey, there's a lot of interest in the budget. The budget's a matter of huge public interest. Would you consider expanding the public debate that you would permit? The city council, and in particular the mayor of Bakersfield, said COVID-19 protocols allow them to make reasonable limits on how they receive public comment and that they were following Robert's rules of order. That still didn't sit well with people, many of whom came up to speak about the police department and about the budget generally and about how they saw the city services need to be reconstituted. Here's Fahima Salahuddin Floyd.
What you are witnessing is anger that has been multiplied over time. When people come and they speak and they give you respect and they speak graciously and they speak perfect King's English, you disregard them. When people come up here and they cuss and they yell and they have righteous anger, which is their right as human beings whose civil liberties are infringed upon, you still don't listen.
In the end, the city council voted unanimously to increase the budget for the city, including the budget for the police department specifically by $13 million to $133 million. That's going to enable the police department to hire 28 more sworn officers.
So policing will now make up 42% of the city's budget, and that this funding is coming from a ballot measure that was passed a few years ago. Do people in Bakersfield agree about what they want from public safety?
You know, Measure N was passed narrowly when it was passed in 2018 by something like 97 votes. And it was meant to increase efforts towards public safety and essential services. It does not seem like there's agreement about what public safety means. Some people said that they wanted to feel safe from the police specifically. Others thanked the police for their response to different incidents. And members of the various chambers of commerce in Bakersfield said they're concerned about crime and they have confidence in the current plans and the city's idea for how to improve public safety by growing the police department. Here's Kaylin Peterson from the Chamber of Commerce.
We support the addition of more police officers in the city of Bakersfield. That was a Measure N campaign promise to the voters and to the community, the business community who supported Measure N, and that they expect the city to follow through on that promise.
Like other places in the Valley, Bakersfield saw protest after George Floyd's death last summer. How has that changed the conversation in Bakersfield about policing and public safety?
Well, at the time last summer, the city council in Bakersfield had appointed a Bakersfield Police Department Community Collaborative, basically a team led by four people to discuss, investigate, and understand various issues with policing, like community trust and community policing, like use of force issues. This community collaborative worked for several months through the early part of the spring and made detailed recommendations, including about the use of force. They brought these recommendations back to the city council, who accepted these recommendations without comment back in May and have not used them in budget planning. So while there's greater awareness since George Floyd's death, it seems like there's a lot of unresolved issues that have existed before that time that go back maybe even as far as 2004 when the Federal Department of Justice, you know, targeted the Bakersfield Police Department with an investigation. And some of those recommendations still aren't implemented.
So what's next for you? Do you plan on doing more reporting?
There definitely seem to be a lot of issues that we've come across that remain of interest to people in Bakersfield and in Kern County. And we're interested in hearing from people in Kern County about what they think we should be talking about in terms of policing. I know that at least one of our cases, for example, has some resonance with mental health issues and how the Bakersfield Police Department has to perform welfare checks and respond to essentially non-criminal activity. So we're looking into all kinds of issues, and we're going to be working with local producers and reporters to produce more reporting through the summer.
Well, before we wrap up, we should mention that this report that we've been discussing can be found on our website, kvpr.org. Molly Peterson with the California Reporting Project, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. After 15 months of pandemic-related restrictions, California is back open for business. Here's how a few of you are feeling.
I'm super grateful.
It's about dang time.
It's like, okay, I can breathe.
I think we should still keep our precautions just to be on the safe side.
That was business owner Sherry Cooley, video producer Nick McNeil, photographer Jeff Pasqua, and nurse Angelica Martinez, speaking with our health reporter Carrie Klein in downtown Clovis earlier this week. The pandemic isn't over, but it seems to be under control. And so because of that, today will be our final weekly COVID update. To commemorate the occasion, Carrie followed up with a few people we've featured in this segment in the last year to see how they're doing and what they'll carry with them from this upside down year. Carrie, welcome back.
Thanks, Kathleen.
First, let's begin, as we always have, with a valley-wide status report.
So once again, things continue to look really stable. Case rates, death rates, and hospitalization rates are still low and not changing very much. So far in our area, nearly 2.1 million vaccine doses have been administered, bringing our fully vaccinated total to 33%, with another 7% of our population partially vaccinated.
And of course, the color-coded reopening blueprint no longer applies anymore. In broad strokes, what changed on Tuesday? Where are we now in terms of social distancing, business reopenings, and masking?
So we covered a lot of this last week, but to recap, under state rules, almost all businesses are free to operate at full capacity and with no requirements for social distancing. The exception is places that hold mega events like stadiums and music venues. There, customers must either test negative or have proof of vaccination. Otherwise, you'll have to wear a mask indoors. You know, generally, fully vaccinated people can go maskless, with just a few exceptions, including healthcare and correctional settings and mass transit. Unvaccinated people are still supposed to wear masks indoors, though it's up to the business in question how they want to enforce that. However, businesses are allowed to enforce their own stricter requirements. For instance, they can require masks of everyone.
And of course, one change from last week is that workplace restrictions have been lifted as well, right?
That's right. So much of the confusion around workplace requirements should be over now. You know, restrictions for employees had looked like they were going to remain in place for a few weeks beyond the loosening of restrictions for the public. But just yesterday, the state Occupational Health and Safety Board voted to end masking and social distancing requirements for employees, or at least for vaccinated employees as well. And Governor Newsom signed an executive order to make that effective immediately. You know, many folks are elated at this news, though officials warn that workplaces may have to follow different rules if they face a subsequent outbreak.
So you caught up with a number of Valley residents in the last week to hear about the lessons that they will walk away with from this pandemic. One group of people really affected by the pandemic is kids. And I understand you spoke with a school employee in Bakersfield.
Yeah, that's right. I talked with Kimberly Reynolds. She's the lead social worker at Kern High School District in Bakersfield. She said it's been great to have students back in classrooms. There was kind of a honeymoon period at first. Everyone was just positive, excited to be back. But over time, requests for social work services have increased, and it's becoming clear there's still a lot of work to do. You know, she had told me that to get through the pandemic, social workers had ramped up their televisits to make up for lost FaceTime. Many even carried folding chairs in their cars in order to meet with students in their front yards. But it's such a relief to be able to see students now in person?
We do a lot of crisis assessments, individual counseling, things like that. And there's so much nonverbal communication that's transferred or that's apparent when you're working with someone face-to-face that you can't necessarily see or gain from a virtual environment.
On the other hand, she says she and her colleagues do feel they have more tools to use now than ever before, and that there is a time and place for virtual visits when in-person time isn't possible.
Another group that's been vulnerable during this pandemic has been essential workers. Tell me about your conversations with employees from some of the Valley's biggest industries.
Yeah, well, so I'll start with Sonny Graywall. He's a trucker owner-operator in Fresno. He drives more than 100,000 miles every year. We first spoke back in March, and at that time, he and truckers across the country were frustrated about what felt like a lack of support from the government. They were left out in the cold when rest stops closed, leaving truckers without bathrooms or places to sleep, even though they were transporting food and PPE and all this really essential stuff. Pay rates for truckers fluctuated tremendously as well, and truckers never received the vaccine priority they were promised early on by the state government. Since then, a lot of this, of course, has stabilized. Vaccines are now available to everyone, or at least all adults. But Graywall says he hasn't forgotten the sting of feeling forgotten about.
I learned that, we should not rely on anybody, because when this pandemic thing happened, we were by our own, We had a regular people sending us messages that we are serving food for truckers they don't have. So when we really needed that support, they shut down everything and people were helping us,
Then there's Eric Bream. He's a citrus farmer in Tulare County. He was fortunate that this year there was a lot of demand for oranges, and so his business wasn't hit too hard, but others were. Demand for produce and meat changed a lot, particularly with restaurants and hotels scaled back, and that's why a lot of livestock had to be slaughtered, and many fruits and vegetables were left out in the field to rot. Not to mention, COVID hit farm workers particularly hard. So, coming out of this episode, Bream says he's trying to evaluate the things that he's taken for granted in his life. For instance, a pipe on his property broke, and it took months to get the parts he needed because the supply chain had broken down somewhere in the world.
We've always kind of operated on the assumption that that stuff will always be readily available, and now it's not. And I think people will be a little more mindful of that moving forward.
He says he's also seen a shift in consumers, many of whom recognize more now that food is not infinite and it can be subject to labor shortages, supply chain hiccups, and other problems, just like any other commodity. And then some of the folks that you heard from at the very beginning of this episode that I met in downtown Clovis, they say they've had to learn to be more creative in terms of how they make money this year. Jeff Pasqua has a career as a photographer and event coordinator, but he had to take a job as a Salvation Army truck driver until weddings and quinceañeras came back. Nick McNeil is a videographer and has spent a lot of time this year reviewing products online instead of working events.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, there is some optimism out there, some silver linings to grab onto as we come out of this pandemic. Is that the right way to view this?
I mean, the people I've interviewed, can't necessarily speak for the entire population. Obviously, there has been tremendous variation in people's experiences. Some families were utterly devastated by COVID. Some people lost their incomes or their homes. But on the whole, Jennifer Howell says she's been really impressed with the resilience of people. She's a health psychologist at UC Merced. We first spoke last summer when she was just beginning some studies on how people were being affected by the pandemic. She says, yes, there have been spikes in anxiety, depression, substance use, things that can't just be reversed when restrictions are lifted. But she says, on the whole, we as a society have shown how adaptable and resilient we can be.
I think people found ways to stave off the kind of negative social impact of COVID, using Zoom or playing games online with people or doing socially distanced picnics or things like that. And I think that one thing that we see is really the resilience of humans and the ability to kind of find a way to remain social despite the limitations.
And collectively, we discovered a lot of coping mechanisms and tools that we can take with us to the next big disaster or even to the littler things that disrupt our lives.
Well, Carrie, thank you so much for your reporting, not just this week, but throughout the pandemic. It has been so informative. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Kathleen.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Yesterday, President Biden signed a bill to make June 19th, known as Juneteenth, a federal holiday. Juneteenth commemorates the day in 1865 when Union soldiers brought word to enslaved Black people in Galveston, Texas, that they were free, roughly 2.5 years after the passage of the Emancipation Proclamation. UC Merced Associate Professor of History Kevin Dawson published a column in the Sacramento Bee last year calling on the government to recognize the day as a holiday. I checked in with him about the significance of this week's news.
Yeah, so I was surprised, but pleasantly surprised that Juneteenth is being recognized as a national holiday. I think it fits in perfectly with our narrative of the United States being a country of freedom, liberty, democracy, and equality.
Well, how do you square this step against the other things we're seeing in the news right now? Research indicating that support of Black Lives Matter among white Americans peaked last summer, but since has dropped to levels below what it was when George Floyd was murdered, you know, along with this attack on critical race theory. I mean, how does all of this sit in your head?
That's a harder question to get at, right? I mean, it's hard to square these kinds of things because on the one hand, Juneteenth, I mean, if we back up for just a second before I answer that question, I mean, what Juneteenth did is that slavery was abolished in kind of a piecemeal fashion during the Civil War, right? And so you have the Emancipation Proclamation being a step towards the abolition of slavery. You have the North winning the Civil War. And then you have the 13th Amendment, which comes after Juneteenth is first celebrated and after the Civil War. But what Juneteenth did is that it actually was it freed slaves. And what it said, what the proclamation said, was that these formerly enslaved people are now equal to white Americans. And so it was this expression of equality. And it's the first time you have a true expression of equality. And it takes place almost 90 years to the date after the Declaration of Independence, right? Which we celebrate on the 4th of July. And so I think it's striking. And I think we need to keep that in mind is what Juneteenth is actually celebrating. We might think that the Declaration of Independence is a celebration of freedom, but it takes place while colonial America was still very much a slave-owning society. Whereas Juneteenth, it's forcing us to deal with the hard questions of our inequality, our injustices. And so to answer your question, I am dismayed that there has been this kind of waning support of Black Lives Matter. I'm not entirely surprised. I mean, we're coming out of a pandemic, and there's been a lot of shifts in people's priorities, but I don't think the lessons of Black Lives Matter are going to be lost, right? I mean, what ends up happening, I think what we need to keep in mind is what happened in those protests last summer, that it was Black Lives Matter protest, but in many ways, most of the people out there in the streets were white Americans. And I don't think they're going to forget those lessons. I don't think the people who were out protesting, and not just the people on the street, but the people who took action in other ways, right? I mean, there were other ways for people to take action rather in addition to just going on the street. And so all of those things, all of those emotional investments, all of those moral investments against injustice, against intolerance, against police brutality, I don't think those are going to go away. And also, I think the coalitions that were formed, right, between Black Americans and white Americans, but between other people of color, Asian Americans, Latinx people. I mean, what we saw in a lot of ways, I mean, I'm very hopeful after last summer. We still have a lot of work to do as a country, but I think that's what Juneteenth is about. I mean, Juneteenth is a recognition of freedom, of liberty, of democracy, but it's also about saying there's work to be done.
So I have heard concerns within the Black community that as Juneteenth grows in popularity, it could
become over commercialized. It could lose its meaning. It could become like a Memorial Day in which, you know, it's about furniture sales, not necessarily the heart of what the holiday is all about. Do you share that concern?
You know, that could happen. That probably will happen, you know, but I don't know that's going to happen in the immediacy, right? I mean, if that happens, I think that's going to happen years down the road. I think that people will still be forced to deal with Juneteenth. I think as Americans actually learn kind of the nuances of Juneteenth and what it's about, right? That it's about this Union general freeing slaves and forcing Americans to deal with this question that we don't want to deal with in America, whether we're Black or white. Most people don't want to deal with the issue of slavery. I mean, it's something that people are embarrassed by, but it's something that we also need to address in order to allow for healing. And so I think that if there's celebrations, people are going to have to ask, you know, what are we celebrating? And so that is going to force people, it's going to force conversations, and it already is forcing conversations.
You know, you write in your piece that was published last year, and I'm quoting from the opinion piece here, "We intentionally forget Juneteenth as it complicates and nuances who we imagine ourselves to be as a country." And that line really resonated with me because I think it really gets to the center of this reckoning that we are being invited to participate in as we consider how the legacy of slavery has shaped the United States. And just your final thoughts on how Juneteenth may help us to move past that and to sort of reimagine who we are as a country.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to touch on and to close on. I mean, we imagine ourselves as a country being founded on these ideals of liberty, democracy, and equality, beginning with kind of the Puritan pilgrim experience in New England. But that's just one American experience, right? We forget, in doing so, we forget that at the time of the American Revolution, all 13 colonies had enslaved Africans in them. Slavery was legal in all 13 American colonies. And it was central, enslaved labor was central in many colonies. And so Juneteenth reminds us that our freedom, that our liberty, democracy was born out of injustice, was born out of slavery in many ways, that slavery produced the capital, produced the wealth that enabled the 13 colonies to rebel against England. I mean, that's one thing that's really important to keep in mind is the wealth that plantation slavery created for the colonies and created for the United States. And so I think it's important to keep that in mind that, you know, freedom is important to Americans, but what was the cost of that freedom? And how did we arrive at that freedom?
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk with us about Juneteenth. I have been talking with Kevin Dawson, Associate Professor of History at UC Merced. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You could hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in California's decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.